Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Can an island remain isolated from the problems brought on by the world beyond its shores? Residents of Gloucester, Massachusetts have fought valiantly to protect their ancient way of life, which bases its economy on fishing and strives to be as self-sufficient as possible. But although fishing has sustained Gloucester for more than 1,000 years, those past successes grant no protection from the hazards of the 21st century, including declining fish stocks, pollution, and climate change. And despite modern technology, the dangers of the job itself are nearly as high as ever. Gloucester was the launch point for the boat that went down in 1991's infamous Perfect Storm. Still, Gloucester is a vibrant and fascinating place, and author Mark Kurlansky captures its essence in his latest book, The Last Fish Tale, The Fate of the Atlantic and the Survival of Gloucester, America's oldest fishing port and most original town. Mark, welcome to Think.
Nice to be here, Chris.
There are, what, about 500 working fishermen in Gloucester right now?
Yeah, about that, yeah.
What sort of people hold those jobs?
Well, about half of them are of Sicilian origin. They're a diverse group. A lot of them come from families of fishermen, going back many generations, both in New England and in Europe. They're blue-collar working Americans.
Do fishermen today want their kids to follow in their footsteps?
Well, some do and some don't. In a perfect world, they would want them to, but most fishermen today recognize that it's just a tough way to go, and there are better things you could do. It's funny. A lot of fishermen want to send their kids off to college. There's some pretty well-known colleges in the area, like Harvard and MIT, and then you hear from these fishermen for about 4 years about, my son at MIT, and then 4 years later they're back and they want to work on the boat, and the father's saying, what have we done wrong here?
You actually worked in Gloucester as a teenager, is that right?
Well, I worked in New England, mm-hmm. Not out of the port of Gloucester, but out of a number of New England ports and commercial fishing boats.
And time was that you could sort of easily walk up and down a dock area and find somebody who needed a hand for the day.
Yeah, that's right. I used to just go from port to port till I found a job. But, most of those ports I used to go to aren't fishing ports anymore. In New England and, in all of the Atlantic and the Gulf and the Pacific Coast, everywhere in the world, really, fishing is in decline and tourism is on the rise. And, the easier money is in tourism, and more fishing ports are turning into recreational areas. And the unusual thing about Gloucester is that, in spite of the fact that it's pretty much broke, they're determined to, as they like to say, keep Gloucester, Gloucester. And they have a lot of zoning and a lot of regulations to try to ensure that it remains a center of commercial fishing.
Yeah, they in fact have outlawed putting tourist businesses and hotels and motels on the waterfront.
In the Central Harbor, yeah, correct. It says that it has to be a marine industrial activity, which a condo, a hotel, a yacht basin is not considered a marine industrial activity.
Why do you think Gloucester has not succumbed to the lure of easier money?
Well, as you said, it's America's oldest fishing port. It was founded as a fishing station in 1623. Has a very long history of commercial fishing, and it's always been what the town is about. And it's a special place because of that. And the people have a sense that they're living in this special place. And, it was manifest in a lot of ways. One of the most important schools of American art is centered around Gloucester because of the artists who came to paint the fishing industry, people like Winslow Homer and, Stuart Davis and Edward Hopper. And it is an iconic place. Writers, Rudyard Kipling, went there to write about the Gloucester Georges Bank fishery, and T.S. Eliot spent his summers there and wrote about Gloucester and the quartets. And in the original, I went to the New York Public Library and got the original pencil-written manuscript of The Wasteland, and it's got pages of lines about Gloucester. The manuscript is all marked up by Ezra Pound, who edited for him, and he cut all the Gloucester passages. So, you know, it would have been the most famous thing ever written about Gloucester, but Pound didn't like it.
Oh, you have a great photograph in the book, too, of T.S. Eliot as a little kid.
Yeah, sitting on his porch reading a book. Like you would imagine, young T.S. Eliot.
Yeah, exactly. You couldn't have drawn a picture that would be more illustrative, I don't think. Mark Kurlansky is my guest. The book is called The Last Fish Tale, The Fate of the Atlantic and the Survival of Gloucester, America's Oldest Fishing Port and Most Original Town. I'm very excited about the timing of our interview, Mark, because this weekend is the Feast of St. Peter. Can you talk about what happens in Gloucester on this very peculiar weekend every year?
Yes. Well, St. Peter is, of course, the patron saint of fishermen and by extension of blue collar. And the Sicilians made this a central festival for Gloucester, and there's a saint of St. Peter that's paraded through the town and a lot of different things. But one of the things that, you know, is just very striking as truly Gloucester is the grease pole competition, which is something that goes back to the 14th century in Sicily. It used to be a greased vertical pole, and it was a test of mast climbing skill. But today in Gloucester, it's horizontal, about 40 feet out over the water, which is pretty cold this time of year. And it's a couple stories above the water. You hit the water pretty hard. And
And how hard depends on where the tide happens to be.
That's right. But you'll also, chances are fair, you'll hit the pole. And the thing is that you're supposed to go to the end. There's about a 6-foot cushion of this stuff that looks like Crisco. And almost as a joke, there's also banana peels embedded in it. And you're supposed to make it to the end of the pole and grab the flag before you fall in. But you fall in either way. Your chances of getting hurt are quite good, and that makes it a very Gloucester experience.
Yeah, and I love that there's a special competition on Sundays for the
right.
people who've actually won in the past, and then the day before, anybody can try it.
That's right. And they tend to dress up in costumes and get very drunk, and because all the waterfront bars give them free drinks. And all the Sicilian families give them pasta, you know, and they set up a chair and a table in front of their house, and one by one they sit down and just gobble down this plate of pasta and get up, and the next one does. And so they're absolutely bloated by the time they get to the boat to take them out to this platform.
Well, for ballast, I guess.
Yes.
Did you consider trying this as part of your research?
Well, I'll tell you, I spent a day with the pole walkers, you know, going from bar to bar, that was okay. And I got on the boat with them out to the platform, and we were all great friends by then, and they all wanted me to come up to the platform with them. And I looked at this thing, and it was pretty obvious that once I got up on the platform, there was only one way I was going to get down. So I just declined.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Mark Kurlansky. The book is called The Last Fish Tale. You know, I mean, it's evident throughout the book, but a town where the year's big event has to do with entertainment derived from climbing a greasy pole or sliding on a greasy pole tells you that there's not always a lot of money flowing. And my understanding is that you can have one really great year and one really lean year. And I'm wondering how that reality affects the culture of Gloucester.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, this has always been the reality of fishing, that most fishermen believe that fish go in cycles, and fishing is quite bad right now, historic lows all over the planet. But a lot of Gloucester fishermen feel like, well, you know, it's the cycle. We've seen this before. And in fact, if you go back in the archives of Gloucester newspapers. I mean, you know, there were various periods in the early 1900s during the American Revolution. There were lots of periods where the paper read like it does today about the fishing crisis and will Gloucester be able to continue. So there is this kind of toughness to Gloucester people of, you know, we've seen all this before. And there are also people who have lived with a lot of tragedy. I mean, you mentioned the Andrea Gale, both that Sebastian Younger wrote about in The Perfect Storm. That was not an unusual incident. You know, almost every year they lose a boat or two, and when they were schooners, you know, schooners were invented in Gloucester as a fishing boat. It's strange to think of a fishing boat so beautiful that today it's only used as a yacht. But they were built for speed, and they were incredibly dangerous, and used to lose sometimes more than 100 people in one night. And it's a terrible way to lose your loved ones, because you don't really ever find out what happens. It's just that they didn't come back.
You have a really poignant story in the book about the watch and wait. Can you tell us that?
Oh, yeah, the watch and wait. Ironically, the names of these boats.
They break your heart.
Yeah, the watch and wait was trying to go around the tip of the peninsula that Gloucester is on, Cape Ann, to cut around Gloucester, which is quite treacherous. And this was in the 1600s, and was just trying to get to the other side, something that would take about 20 minutes today. But it was a voyage of a couple of days, and they were rounding the tip, and a storm kicked up, and they wrecked on the on this island, everybody was lost except strangely this one man and his wife, who lost all of their children, but they were washed ashore. A guy named Thatcher. And it was famous. It was called Thatcher's Woe. Today it's called Thatcher's Island, and it has these twin lighthouses that mark, you know, when you're at sea, it's the first thing that you see that tells you that you're getting into Gloucester. But it was this heartbreaking story of these people that, you know, they just lost all their family, and you know, for that was the original thing that Gloucester was famous for, was this tragedy. You know, a lot of people, you know, T.S. Eliot wrote about ships being wrecked rounding Gloucester, and there's that famous Longfellow poem, The Wreck of the Hesperus, about the captain and
his daughter strapped to the mast, and all that, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, which is a really heartbreaking poem. There's a famous monument in Gloucester, and it lists 5,000 names, 5,000 of Gloucestermen that have been lost at sea. And historians think that that's only half of the total number. Winslow Homer did some very poignant paintings of children anxiously looking on the horizon, which is what kids used to do to see if their father was going to make it back or not.
We are speaking with author Mark Kurlansky about his new book, The Last Fish Tale, The Fate of the Atlantic and the Survival of Gloucester, America's oldest fishing port and most original town. After the break, we will talk more about Gloucester in the 21st century, including how they treat those widows and orphans left over when fishermen don't come back from sea. Our telephone number, if you'd like to join us, is 1-800-933-5372. The email address is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, a way to keep your greatest two tools, imagination and curiosity, sharp.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Mark Kurlansky. His newest book is called The Last Fish Tale, The Fate of the Atlantic and the Survival of Gloucester, America's oldest fishing port and most original town. If you'd like to join us, you can send email to think@kera.org or you can call 1-800-933-5372. You certainly get the sense that the fact that people in Gloucester sort of regularly lose those they know, and it is still a very small community, has kept them closer knit than another community in the same situation might be.
Yeah, I think that's right. There is a tremendous sense of community and belonging to this special place and sharing a common heritage, even though it's, you know, ethnically very diverse.
Well, and what's really unique about that as well is that although they've been kept very close, the fact that they have to continue replacing people keeps them from being sort of closed-minded.
Yeah, it's always, you know, it's always been a place that where there was work because of fishing, and so people could come there and find work. Gloucester is a man-made island. It's connected to the rest of Massachusetts by about a, you know, maybe 5 or 10 foot strip of land that was cut through in the 1600s so that ships wouldn't have to go around like the Watch and Wait did, so they could take this safer path through. And the result of that is that it's an island and it has a very insular mentality, and there used to be people who never left the island, even though, you know, you could almost hop across it. And so the fishery was very self-sufficient. They built their own ships from local forests and made their own nets, and Jews from the garment trade in New York came to Gloucester to make the clothing for fishermen, and it was a place that had a, in a sense, a fairly diverse economy, but it was all about fishing.
We are finally starting to hear globally often about the dangers of overfishing and start to understand this problem. But you found evidence that Gloucester understood this a century ago.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, when they first started using engine power to drag nets over the side of boats, which began in the North Sea in the 1880s, and they quickly learned that you couldn't do this very well with sail power because you need to keep you have to have a constant speed or the net will waffle, so you need an engine to keep it steady. And they started doing this, and within 10 years, by the 1890s, there was a clear decline in fish stocks in the North Sea. And fishermen in other parts of Britain started protesting this, this type of fishing. But it did spread, and decline of fish stocks in other British waters followed. And in the early 20th century, the first stern trawlers came to Gloucester. And in 1911, the Gloucester Daily Times, which is still publishing, ran this huge article, it was most of the newspaper, about these stern trawlers and about fishermen organizing in Gloucester and throughout New England to petition Congress to ban this type of fishing. And it gave the whole history of what had happened in British waters, and it talked about the destruction of the ocean bottom and the destruction of fish stocks, and it said that you will never be able to compensate but for this by having fishermen throw some of the fish back. And it warned that we have to ban it now because these things are expensive, and once the investments are made, it'll be very hard to stop it. And it was like a prophecy.
So how is it done now? How does a typical Gloucester fishing crew, what does it take with it out to sea, and sort of how does it operate?
Well, the Gloucester fleet, like most commercial fishing in recent years, has become considerably smaller. I mean, the size of the boats has become smaller, and the distances that they fish have become less. And this is partly a function of oil prices. But they still use bottom dragging, and they use gill netting, which is anchoring a net in the ocean bottom. The fish literally get caught by the gills. And problem with gill netting is that sometimes the nets break away so that you can't find them, and they just sort of travel around the ocean trapping fish until they become so heavy with fish that they collapse on the bottom, and other fish eat them, and it becomes very wasteful too. But at least it's not as destructive of the bottom as dragging is. But the fishermen live a very regulated life now. The thing that fishermen always loved about being a fisherman is that nobody told you what to do, and you were on your own. And going back for centuries, fishermen have never been salaried employees. They've always worked for a share of the catch, and they felt like free, independent workers. And I mean, I remember when I was a kid going out and just, you know, I'd come back to port, and you know, you just feel sorry for all those suckers who were stuck on land. You know, and it was just that kind of mentality of this wonderful, free way of life, even if it was a bit dangerous. Actually considered the most dangerous job in America.
Yeah, were your parents okay with you doing this? Is it sort of an odd job when you were young?
Well, odd is the operative word there. They thought it was very peculiar. I don't come from a maritime tradition, to say the least. They couldn't figure out why I was doing this at all.
Trust me, in 30 years I'm going to be writing books.
Well, I did have those thoughts because I always wanted to be a writer. You know, nowadays, a fisherman is very constricted about the number of days he can go out and fish, and where he can fish, and what he can fish for, and how much he can catch, and he has to call up the regulators to say when he's leaving and where he's going, and when he gets there before he starts fishing, he has to call them again and say, you know, what he's doing and what he's targeting, and then he has to call them again to say what his catch was and where he's landing it, and then an agent meets him at the dock where he comes in, and there's this box in the pilot house, and somewhere in a government office somebody is monitoring his every movement. And, you know, what fishermen often say is, you know, it's just not any fun anymore. Because you might wonder why they ever thought it was fun, but it was more fun than it is now.
Are they pretty respectful of those regulations, or are they more than happy to be scofflaws if they're not caught?
They are. I mean, it's sort of hard to answer that question the way you ask it, because they will be caught, so they don't do it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there is a lot of enforcement, so, I mean, there's a feeling on the part of government that they might not do it if there wasn't that enforcement, but they do do it, and they've been doing it for years now.
So it's like the seatbelt laws. People have become accustomed to.
Right. Mm-hmm. And you know, I mean, fishermen aren't stupid. They know that if there's no more fish, there'll be no more fishing, and you know, that there need to be regulations, and they sometimes argue that the regulators don't know what they're doing, and they're not doing it right, but nobody argues that it doesn't need to be regulated, and
yeah.
You know, always had this promise that if they follow the rules in time, it'll get better. And it hasn't been getting better. And so this is a great sore point also. They feel, you know, somewhat betrayed by government and science that, you know, they did what was asked of them, and it hasn't worked as promised.
Is it a matter of the regulations and the preservation plans not really taking the entire ecosystem into account? They're sort of going piecemeal?
Well, I think that's one of the problems, and that's a problem that begins with science. You know, science is all about funding, getting funding for research. And in marine biology, you tend to get funding when a fish stock collapses, when the cod collapsed from the Grand Banks of Canada, so there was a lot of funding to study cod, which hadn't been studied much before. And so what you get is all of these fish experts. So, you know, the cod expert says that there's less and less cod, and then the herring expert says that there's more and more herring, and there's nobody there, you know, thinking about how cod eats herring. So maybe, you know, there's a connection there. And there's a lack of study of the ecosystem, including what is the effect of climate change. And logic will tell you that the effect is probably enormous, but it really hasn't been researched that much. Fish swim at a certain temperature, and then at a certain change of temperature, it's their signal to spawn. So if those temperatures have all changed, are they getting the signal to spawn at all? Maybe, you know, there's fish that just aren't spawning anymore. We don't really know. Are they moving to other places because of changes in salinity? You know, polar ice caps are melting. The salinity of the sea is changing tremendously. And this stuff isn't studied enough. The effect of pollution isn't studied enough. You know, things are not going well, and it's not for it's not that nobody's been trying. I mean, there's two very different kinds of problems. There's you know, there's the domestic fisheries, the people who go out in New England and the Carolinas and the Chesapeake and the Gulf and along the Pacific, and these are all very regulated fisheries. And then there are big companies that make contracts to go to poor countries and do very destructive things off of Peru and Senegal, and that's a different issue that, you know, needs a lot more international cooperation. But the you know, the domestic fisheries are regulated, mandated by Congress, and you know, there's supposed to be things in place that you know, are supposed to make it work, and it's not really working.
Mark Kurlansky is my guest. His book is called The Last Fish Tale, The Fate of the Atlantic and the Survival of Gloucester, America's Oldest Fishing Port and Most Original Town. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's speak to Ken in Plano. Hi, Ken.
Hi. I grew up in the suburbs, so there'd be no way for me to know what it's like to live in Gloucester, and I was wondering if you could just comment on the attachment, the emotional attachment that these people must have to the sea. By way of context, I've got a friend who's a farmer, and he's been on that land for 150 years, and he once pointed over and he said, Ken, you grew up in the city, you have no clue what it's like, to the affection that my family has for, and he pointed out to his land. So is it a little bit like that?
Yes. There's a lot of parallels between fishermen and farmers, you know, one of the big fears of fishermen is they look at what's happened to farming in this country and agro-industry overrunning family farms, and there's this big fear that that's what will happen to fishing, that, you know, fishing will continue, but it will end up being controlled by a handful of large companies rather than small family operations. I would imagine that farmers could very easily relate to the troubles of fishermen. When you live in Gloucester, you are always by the water. It just sort of cuts in everywhere, and it's ever present, and it's part of everybody's life.
How much does weather change the way they operate from day to day and season to season?
I mentioned that they still lose a boat or two every year. That's usually in the winter. Winter fishing has always been and remains much more dangerous. One of the things that happens that's really dangerous is that a vessel will tend to ice up on the windward side, and then that side, because it has all that ice, becomes very heavy, and it causes the whole boat to capsize. So when it starts icing up, and obviously it's icing up in very bad weather conditions, you know, you have to be out there chopping all the ice off of the rigging and off of the boat. I have a picture in the book from I guess early 1900s of fishermen out there with hatchets trying to chop the ice off, a line, one-inch thick line of rope is now 6 inches thick of ice, and you have to get that ice off, and they lose a lot of ships that way.
Is it a matter of, would one Gloucester fisherman sort of criticize another for making a bad decision to go out in certain weather, or does everyone understand you got to make a living, you got to be out there regardless of what the conditions look like?
Well, yeah, they don't like to talk that way. You know, it's a tragedy that's personal. You know,
they all know these guys.
Yeah, and any boat that goes down, you know, they didn't really like the subject of the perfect storm because they didn't want to talk a lot about that. That is something that happens all the time, and they don't want to talk about it. After when it became a movie and George Clooney came to town, they liked it much more. But, you know, that the Andrea Gale was a case in point. It shouldn't have been out there. One of the great advantages of modern fishing is that you have a U.S. Weather Service that tells you when storms are coming, and you get in and you don't go out. Those guys made some bad mistakes, but you know, people don't want to go around saying, you know, knocking them because. You know, everybody makes their call, and it's just very sad.
Mark Kurlansky is my guest. His new book is called The Last Fish Tale, The Fate of the Atlantic and the Survival of Gloucester, America's oldest fishing port and most original town. We'll take more of your calls right after the break. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. The email address is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, a way to keep your greatest two tools, imagination and curiosity, sharp.
You are listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with author Mark Kurlansky, whose latest book is called The Last Fish Tale, The Fate of the Atlantic and the Survival of Gloucester, America's oldest fishing port and most original town. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. The email address is think@kera.org. Let's speak to Bob in Richardson. Hi, Bob.
Hi. I just tuned in. Have you mentioned the movie with Spencer Tracy, Captain Courageous, which is about a fishing boat off of the coast that picked up a wealthy boy and wouldn't bring him back till the trip was over?
We have not discussed that.
Well, I briefly mentioned that Rudyard Kipling came to Gloucester to write it, and in fact only went to sea for half of a day and was too seasick to take notes, and unlike the boy in his book, did get brought back and never went to sea again, but did a remarkable job of describing George's Bank, where he'd never been.
So he came pretty close.
Yeah, it's the description in the book. I mean, you get a real sense of what it was like to be in a Gloucester schooner out in the Banks, and it's quite remarkable considering he never did it.
One thing we haven't mentioned yet that we should is that the book has some recipes in it, and I'm wondering if you would talk about how seriously people in Gloucester take the preparation and consumption of their product.
Well, you know, there are a lot of different levels of ethnicity to Gloucester, there's a lot of different kinds of food. You know, like everywhere else in New England, there's a tremendous debate over who does chowder right, and you know, who has good fried clams, but things like Portuguese linguiça sausage are also very central to Gloucester eating, as is espresso and cannolis. And I tried to show from the recipes in my book that Gloucester food is a lot of different things. People talk recipes a lot in Gloucester. You know, if you hang around the docks or in hair salons or, you know, on the street, it's funny how often people are talking about, especially the Sicilians, about recipes. But, you know, the Portuguese, grow kale in their gardens because kale is a traditional food that you don't find much in American markets, so they grow their own. A lot of people make salt cod, which, was the traditional Gloucester product that nobody makes anymore. So people make it in their homes for holidays, particularly Christmas and New Year's. Which must make the house quite smelly certain times of year.
Is salt cod, does that dish have pomegranate seeds in it? And is it mixed up that way?
Pomegranate seeds, no.
No, okay. There's another Portuguese dish that I'm thinking of, but you have a funny quote in there. The people in the book come across as sort of appealingly snobbish about the way they cook. There's one point where they say, "Well, real Sicilians don't use that curly parsley garbage. We have to have a particular kind of Italian
right.
parsley."
Right. It's my friend Paolo Giammatera, who has a cafe, gave me his recipes clandestinely when his wife wasn't listening because she didn't want to share them.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Pat in Richardson. Hello, Pat.
Hi. I have, I guess, a question and a comment. I've been up to Gloucester, about 3 or 4 times. My daughter lives up in Boston, and we go whale watching when we go to Gloucester, and that's a lot of fun.
Yeah,
the other thing is that we watch Deadliest Catch, and I'm wondering, do you think that's made people realize the dangers and the risks of fishing? And you were talking about the ice, and that's what reminded me of it. Thanks.
Well, I was looking at Deadliest Catch the other night, and it's a very different kind of fishery. They go out for 9 months at a time, and those guys aren't really much like the fishermen that I know. They're fishermen that I've worked with and known have a very tight sense of camaraderie and aren't quite as hard on each other as those guys are. But that may have something to do with the nature of reality television. What that does to the whole scene when they're there, I don't know. It is dangerous. And as far as the whale watching goes, whale watching, whales have become really plentiful off of Gloucester because there are a lot of sand eels, which humpbacks and finback whales eat. Fish like cod used to eat them. It's the absence of some of the larger predatory fish that have made for more food for the whales, which, of course, are protected, so nobody is hunting them. So we're kind of entering into a weird world in which, you know, we've been very good about protecting marine mammals and not as good about protecting fish. And so more and more we're coming to a sea that's full of seals and whales and not many fish, which is going to be a problem because the seals and whales aren't going to have anything to eat.
Do you think that comes down to our tendency to anthropomorphize mammals as opposed to fish?
Absolutely. It's just very clear that we are much more sentimental about fellow mammals. This has become a real issue in New England because there's just many more seals than there used to be, and they eat huge amounts of fish, especially cod, which really angers the fishermen. But, the fishermen like to reopen the seal hunt, and boy, when you talk about that, people get really angry. But, you know, nature has this strange way of interconnecting. Great white sharks like seal. And, you know, places like Cape Cod, which are tourist places, will probably start seeing an increase in predatory sharks. You know, in the meantime, the inshore cod fishery, which was a very sustainable hook-and-line fishery, is having trouble finding codfish anymore because there's so many seals there eating it. It just shows how, you know, we've just messed with the balance of nature, and it's going to be very hard to get it right again.
Yeah, even in cases where we seem to mean well.
Right.
Yeah. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Leah in Dallas. Hi, Leah.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead, please.
Sure. Hey, Mark, I just want to tell you that your book sounds great, and I'm definitely going to read it.
Great.
What
Thank
I
you.
Wanted to ask you is, you know, when I was living in Boston, I live in Dallas now, but I was lobstering through college and absolutely fell in love with it. But, you know, in fact, even I had a boat for a while myself, but, you know, it couldn't make a living because of numerous economic problems in that industry. And I ended up working in construction. I became a pile driver, worked on the big dig. And I worked with so many other fishermen that had to leave that industry and ended up in construction in the Boston area. And just wondered, did you touch upon that in your book?
Yeah, well, you know, a part of that is that real estate prices go up. And fishermen suddenly find that this home that they didn't pay a lot for is worth a lot more than their fishing operation. So they sell their home, and then they can't buy anything else because they're expensive, and they go to other places like Peabody and Washington and Boston, which you know are not fishing places, and they find. Other stuff. Interestingly, a lot of fishermen in Gloucester that leave fishing go into real estate. They've seen where the money is.
Yeah, it must be peculiar to turn around and sell something that has been sort of just sustaining you barely as a shelter for huge amounts of money. I would imagine the temptation for good people who meant to stay in fishing is just too much sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, that's what's happened to a lot of. That's what happened to Cape Cod, is, you know, in Nantucket and all of these places in New England that have become famously tourist places. They used to be fishing places, and you know, the fishermen can't afford to live there anymore. The ones that were living there, you know, the great opportunity of their lives was selling their little house.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. The email address is think@kera.org. An email from Sean says, I've read that due to high diesel prices, much of the fleet is at the dock. The amount they get from a load of fish doesn't come close to paying for the fuel to get it. Is this true?
Well, in principle, it's true, but it's not so much that they're at the dock. It's that they're fishing more inshore. And the problem is that there's too much pressure on inshore fisheries now because nobody wants to spend the fuel to go out far, and you know this is going to lead to some problems in inshore fishing grounds.
How far are they allowed to go? What is there a maximum distance from shore?
Well, no. I mean, there's a U.S. grounds are, you know, like. Most countries in the world are 200 miles out, but most good fishing grounds are within 200 miles. Most fish live on continental shelves. They don't live out in the deep ocean. People don't tend to realize that. You're out in the middle of the ocean, there's hardly any fish. They're on the shelves that ocean life, like land life, is very dependent on the penetration of sunlight to create plants and organic things that fish feed on. Generally, they don't want to go out terribly far. You can fish in international waters if you want, but in most of the U.S., the good fishing grounds are within territorial waters.
So they're out. Is this typically a one-day proposition that they'll sort of go out at a particular hour, get as far as they need to be, bring their catch back the same within the same 24-hour period?
Well, not always, especially with bottom draggers that go out for a few days. An interesting market mechanism is more and more coming into play that, you know, if fishermen are to catch fewer and fewer fish, they need to make more money per pound for the fish that they do catch. And the way to do that is to have a better product, so to land it sooner, so-called day boats, you know, boats that go out and come back that day so that the fish is
fresher.
Only a day old, you get a much better price that way. So, you know, more and more that's happening.
And is it preserved mostly in just ice, or is there are there sort of refrigeration containers on every single unit that would go out?
It's mostly iced down, yeah, which is a pretty old way of doing it. You know, it works for a day or two, but it, you know, there is some deterioration of a fish that's brought in after being iced down for a few days is clearly not as good as a fish that was caught that day.
Were you surprised, Mark, at how fishermen who are certainly not ignorant people but may not have a great deal of formal education, how aware they are of issues like global warming?
Well, you know, it's interesting. They're more and more and very aware of issues of pollution and things like, you know, offshore oil drilling, which has suddenly become very much in the news again, is a big issue for fishermen. And environmentalists strangely don't want to talk to fishermen about these issues because they feel that, you know, they're trying to change the subject or something. But these are very important issues to fishing, and, you know, more and more, you know, fishermen are very concerned about climate change and pollution, and especially oil.
I read something about you, and I can't tell if it's a fish tale itself or if it's actually true, that you blow into a conch shell every time you finish a manuscript.
Where'd you read that?
Gosh, I can't remember.
It's absolutely true.
It is true. Okay.
My first book was about the Caribbean.
Uh-huh.
And conch shells were, historically, in slave times, were a symbol for a slave uprising. And so they've become a symbol of freedom. And just kind of as a joke, when I finished my first book, which was about the Caribbean, I blew into a conch shell. And, I've done that with every manuscript since.
Well, we might have to try that. That is a great story. Mark, the book is really, really interesting. It's called The Last Fishtail, The Fate of the Atlantic and the Survival of Gloucester, America's Oldest Fishing Port and Most Original Town. It's been a real pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us, Mark.
Thank you. Nice talking to you, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.